With a global pandemic that's now hitting parts of Wisconsin harder than ever, alternatives to voting in person in November's election might sound more attractive. But voting away from the perceived security of the physical polling place also comes with questions. To help answer them and to discuss the security of this election process in Wisconsin, we have Megan Wolf. She's administrator of the Wisconsin Elections Commission. Megan, welcome back to Central Time.
Well, thanks so much for having me.
As we talk about voting right now in the lead up to the official election day, let's review our terms before we dig in too far. We hear phrases like early voting, absentee voting, vote by mail. Are we talking about the same thing here, or do we need to do a little bit of breakdown?
You know, we might need to do a little bit of a breakdown. For election nerds like me, those different phrases actually have different meanings. So here in the state of Wisconsin, we have a request-based system to receive your absentee ballot by mail. So if a voter chooses to get their absentee ballot by mail, they have to make a request first, and then they're sent a ballot. And so we call that absentee by mail here in the state of Wisconsin. Also, when it comes to casting your vote in person at the poll or in person before Election Day, there's different ways that that can be done in different states. Here in Wisconsin, again, we have in-person absentee. And what that means is you're going to fill out your absentee ballot at your clerk's office during in-person absentee, but you're going to put that into a certificate envelope that's going to remain sealed, and that ballot is going to be counted at the polls on election day. Early voting in some states has a different distinction where the voter is actually feeding that ballot before election day into the voting equipment to be tabulated. We do not do that here in the state of Wisconsin. It's not allowed under our law.
And then voting by mail, early voting could, I guess, encompass both. But then there are nuances, whether you are in person or whether you are mailing in a ballot or dropping it off in a box, those sorts of things.
Yeah. And I think, you know, with voting by mail, you know, sometimes in some states, they don't always have a request-based process. So in some states, they automatically receive their ballot by mail. And sometimes that's referred to as vote by mail. Again, here in the state of Wisconsin, it's a request-based process. So we call that absentee by mail.
What are some of the crucial deadlines to remind people, online registration, requesting those absentee ballots, things that people should just know that are the nuts and bolts?
Definitely. So registration, that's the first step here. So before you can participate or choose what option you want to utilize to cast your ballot, you have to be registered to vote. And you can do that right now, either by mail or you can do it online. If you have a current and valid state of Wisconsin driver license or state ID card, if you're able to match your information with what's on file with the DMV, you can get registered to vote online at myvote.wy.gov. And then that process ends by state statute 20 days before the election, but there currently are some court rulings that may extend that an additional week, but there's a stay on that court order right now. So you need to get that done before October 20th if you want to register to vote online. But then, of course, we also have registration at your clerk's office. In the days leading up to the election, you can register to vote in your municipal clerk's office. And then, of course, we have Election Day registration here in the state of Wisconsin as well.
Yeah. Megan Wolf is administrator of the Wisconsin Elections Commission, and we're talking about voting this year through mail or in person, ahead of time, or on Election Day. And you're part of our conversation. Join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think more people should vote absentee regularly? Maybe you have some concerns about the process. Ask your question by calling 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas at WPR.org. Megan, some people in Wisconsin, they have voted by mail for the first time ever in April or maybe the August election. But for people who haven't gone through that process yet and they think this would be a good first time that they want to vote absentee, what are some of the things that they should be thinking about to make sure that their vote counts?
Right. Yeah. So Wisconsin voters have all three methods available to them, and they can choose what option works best for them. So if you choose to vote absentee by mail, we suggest that you put in your request as soon as you're able. And what this will do is allow you enough time to get that ballot to you sent by mail, and also time for you to get that ballot back in time to be counted. And also, if there's any kind of issue, it gives you some time for your clerk to recognize that issue. Let's say you forgot to have your witness sign, and to be able to remedy that. And so time is really, really important if you choose to vote absentee by mail. The mail service says it could take up to a week for you to receive that absentee ballot, and then, of course, up to a week for that ballot to go back if you send it back by mail. People should also keep in mind that they're able to make those absentee ballot requests. So as long as you're a registered voter, so that's the important part. You have to be registered before you can make the request. Once you're registered, you can make your request for an absentee ballot, again, on myvote.wy.gov. You could also send an email to your municipal clerk, or you can make your request in writing, either using an application form or just by sending them a letter with your information, and they'll be sending you an absentee ballot. But again, each of those transactions by mail can take up to a week. You do, by state law, have until the Thursday before the election to make an absentee ballot request by mail, but don't wait that long, because that's probably not going to set you up for success in order to get that ballot in time and then to be able to get it back. If you do get your ballot and you're worried about getting it back in time to be counted, so by state law, all absentee ballots must be received by 8 p.m. on election day to be counted. And so if you're worried that your ballot might not make it back in time, you're also going to have other options, such as returning that ballot to your municipal clerk's office in person. Many communities also have things like drop boxes where you might be able to also drop off your ballot to make sure that it makes it back in time to be counted. And then the last thing I'll say about that, too, is you can also track your absentee ballots on myvote.wy.gov, and it'll let you know when your ballot has been received by your municipal clerk. And if there's any kind of issue, so let's say, again, you forgot to include your witness signature on it, the voter forgot to sign the certificate, they will also be alerted there if your municipal clerk has entered data to show that there's some kind of deficiency on your certificate. You'll see that there, too, and you'll be able to contact your clerk to get that fixed before Election Day.
We are talking with Megan Wolf of the Wisconsin Elections Commission, and we're taking your calls at 800-642-1234. We've got Don from Madison who wants to join the conversation. Hi, Don.
Hi. I have a question on an absentee ballot. The certificate where you put information on that. How is your vote when it's counted and tabulated? How is it remain confidential?
Okay, Don, you're breaking up a little bit, so I want to make sure Megan hears the question. It's if you vote absentee, you have to put a name and address. It's on the envelope. So how do you guarantee that the ballot is confidential, Megan?
Right. So your ballot goes inside of a certificate envelope. And so there's a process established by law so that when your municipal clerk receives your absentee ballot, your voted absentee ballot, it stays in that envelope until Election Day, when your ballot is sent down to your polling place, just like as if you were there on Election Day. You're assigned a voter number, your name and address are announced, and the first step is they're looking at that certificate to make sure all the elements are there. If all the elements are there, then they're going to take your ballot out of the envelope and put it in basically an anonymized stack of ballots before it's tabulated. So now your ballot is no longer associated with that certificate envelope, and there's no way to trace back who you voted for. They're just looking to make sure that you've met all the requirements of the law. But there's nothing on your ballot. There's no way for them to tie that ballot back to how you actually voted.
So you do that opening en masse so that the ballots are separated kind of all at the same time from the envelope so that you can't say, oh, well, this is who this person voted for by holding them side by side?
That's right. Exactly. There's no that exactly. So once the certificate is deemed to be complete and there's no deficiencies, then that ballot is removed and you've now been anonymized, and that ballot is going to go in to be tallied.
All right. We're talking with the Wisconsin Elections Commission Administrator Megan Wolf, and we're taking your questions here on Central Time, 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about early voting? Maybe you've already voted early. How did you do it? What was the experience like? Do you have any concerns about your vote? Let's talk about it at 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. This conversation continues ahead. You're listening to Central Time. We are 35 days out from Election Day, and voting is already happening here in Wisconsin. We're going over how it's all going to work and what we can do to cast our ballots and make sure that they're counted. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Keely Boltina. We're talking with Wisconsin Elections Commission Administrator Megan Wolf, and we're taking your calls at 800-642-1234. Stephen in Madison is ready to talk with us. Hi, Stephen.
Hi, how's it going, guys?
Good, thanks. What are you wondering? Good.
So here's my question. Right now, there's still time for me to stand to get my mail-in ballot, which I want to do because I want to avoid, you know, COVID. I don't want to get sick. However, I'm very concerned that by the end of this election, and it seems like it's going to happen anyways, we're going to be counting votes for maybe a day or two or more following November 3rd. So I'm thinking ahead and trying to think, is it safer so my vote doesn't get thrown out or something if I vote in person or to mail it in? Because I think back to 2000 where people are looking at signatures saying, oh, this isn't so-and-so, let's toss this out. Whereas I don't know if that happens as much if you vote in person.
Yeah, Stephen, thanks so much for that question. Megan, how do you respond?
Sure. So absentee voting. So a lot of times there is a lot of misinformation. So thanks for that question about the process and about when absentee ballots get counted. And all absentee ballots get counted during the election. So there's not a cutoff time when ballots stop being counted. And, you know, also we have different safeguards in place than what you might hear in other states. In some states, there's things like signature compare on those ballots. In our state, we have different safety measures in place, such as that, again, that request-based system, having to provide a photo ID with your absentee ballot request. And so those safeguards are done on the front end. On the back end of the process, though, what they are looking for is they're making sure that the voter signed that absentee ballot certificate and that their witness has signed and included their address. And so those are really important fields and things to pay attention to. So voters, if they're voting absentee by mail, you do need to make sure that you're filling out that certificate correctly, because if the certificate is not correctly filled out, then that might be reason for your ballot not to count. And so if you're following the instructions and if you're allowing yourself enough time so that if there is a problem, your clerk can let you know and provide you with opportunities to fix it, then that ballot's going to be counted. But if there are problems and if it's received right before the election and there's not time to fix it, then, you know, you may run that risk. And so I think voters just need to come up with a plan as far as how do you want to cast your ballot, and then make sure that you have enough time to be successful in executing that plan and your ballot will be counted.
All right. Thanks again for that call, Stephen. Sounds like timing is everything. We've got John in Fitchburg who wants to join the conversation. Hey, John.
Hey, Keely. Hey, Megan. I've got a question. It has to do with the photo ID. You just referred to that with respect to absentee ballot requests. If I want to request an absentee ballot, can I put my driver's license in there, and then will they return it when they send me the absentee ballot?
John, are you talking about, like, sending in a physical request then?
Yes.
Okay. Megan.
Yeah. Thank you so much for that question, because I think this does come up quite often, actually, is when you're submitting your absentee ballot request, please send your local election official a copy of your photo ID. Don't send us the actual real thing. It does happen sometimes. Sometimes people are confused and they'll accidentally send that, and then the clerk will do their best to get that back to you. But please send a photocopy of your photo ID with that absentee ballot request. And then your clerk is going to store that photocopy along with your voter record, and they're going to keep that on file because the law actually says that you only have to provide a photo ID with the first absentee ballot request that you make. And so they're going to keep that on file for you securely. I should also mention that there are some voters that are actually exempt from the photo ID law. So if you're unable to get to the polls for reason of age, illness, infirmity, or disability, and this is a self-certification of the voter, then you can mark that. You can sign your absentee ballot request certifying that you're indefinitely confined, and then you're actually exempt from the photo ID requirement.
Excellent. John, I hope that helps. So instead of sending that driver's license, it sounds like a photocopy will work just fine if you can manage that. So hopefully that gives you more info. We're talking with Megan Wolf, who's the administrator of the Wisconsin Elections Commission, and we're discussing voting this year through mail or in person on Election Day and ahead of time. We're taking your calls about that. And we've got Dorothy in Greendale who has a question for us. Hi, Dorothy.
Hi. My question relates to voting absentee in person. I looked on the website, and I had a little difficulty finding exactly which days would be available and which time periods. And I'm wondering, with 1,900 municipalities or 1,800 in our state, if each municipality possibly sets within a time parameter of 14 days before the election and no more than like 2 days before it has to end, within that time parameter, if they set their own days and times for voting in person by absentee ballot.
Dorothy, thanks for the question. Megan, what about consistency or inconsistency when it comes to being able to vote in person absentee in Wisconsin?
Well, Dorothy, you hit the nail on the head. That's exactly how the law is structured. It says that absentee, in-person absentee voting can't start until 14 days before the election, and it has to end by the Sunday before the election. But within that time period, each of our 1,850 cities, towns, and villages establish their hours and opportunities and locations for in-person absentee. And so right now we're actually working to collect that information from all 1,850 so that we can display that on the MyVote site, on myvote.wi.gov. But like you referenced, right now, if you look, it's going to say you have to contact your municipal clerk, and then we give you contact information for your municipal clerk because they're the ones that establish that time frame, and each of the 1,850 is different. In some of our small townships, they might just do it by appointment. And so talking to your municipal clerk will really give you the best information about what in-person absentee opportunities are available to you in your community.
Great. So it sounds like, Dorothy, anybody should really check locally then and figure out what's happening in their community where they vote. Mm-hmm. We've got Will from Watertown on the line who has a question for us. Hi, Will.
Hello. Okay, similar question to the last caller. I have an absentee ballot ready to fill out, and I am debating whether to fill it out and send it. We don't have a drop box, as far as I know, at our town hall. So I would like to, I'm considering walking it in on the two dates that we have available for early voting. If I do so, I believe I can take my absentee ballot in, show it to the clerks, ask them, I'll destroy it in person in front of them. They can put it in their spoils pile. And I would then perhaps decide to vote in person on early voting. Or could I just simply walk the ballot in at that point and hand it to them? So my question is, I'd either rip it up and decide to vote in person or just turn it in at that point. Is either of those options viable?
Will, thanks for that question. Megan Wolf, what can Will do?
Yeah, so those are great questions. So you actually have either of those options. So any voter that would like to can return their absentee ballot to their municipal clerk's office. Now, depending where you live, they might have drop boxes, they might have multiple locations. In smaller townships, you might have to make an appointment or call your municipal clerk to find out where they want you to drop it off. But you can drop off your ballot with your municipal clerk, but you should contact them to find out where and when you're able to do that in your community. So you could even do that now if you wanted. You could call your municipal clerk and say, I'd like to bring my ballot back in person. and you could bring the ballot back, your voted ballot that's already been, you know, signed and witnessed. You could bring that back to your clerk or put it in a Dropbox now. You could, like you said, bring it back during in-person absentee. Or, yes, you could also choose to cancel that absentee ballot that was sent to you by mail and then instead cast your ballot either during in-person absentee or at the polls on election day. Now, I should note, though, and this is very important, that if you've returned your absentee ballot, so if you've mailed back your absentee ballot and we're close to the election, so we're after the Thursday before the election, you can no longer cancel that ballot and you can no longer be issued a ballot in person at the polls once you've returned that ballot. And so, again, I think just kind of coming up with a plan and figuring out how you want to get your ballot and how you want to get it back is really important at this juncture to make sure you have enough time.
I do want to touch, Megan, on the idea of security. I mean, this past weekend in Madison, every city park became an early vote drop-off center. There are some communities that have drop-off boxes instead of going through the mail or other events like that. I mean, what kind of security or what confidence can we have that those events or those drop boxes will get our vote or, you know, actually to the right place so it's counted?
Right. So each jurisdiction is, again, responsible for establishing those opportunities. So each city, town, and village is responsible for establishing how and where those ballots can be dropped off, and also ensuring that those opportunities are secure as well. And so, of course, we recommend, although the statute doesn't specifically talk about security for things like drop boxes, we have best practices that we encourage the local election officials to follow if they are to choose those options. So things like making sure that those boxes are secure, that they're emptied regularly by somebody that's been deputized from that jurisdiction to be able to handle the ballots. We recommend things like a chain of custody be used so that they understand exactly who's touched it and who's been involved in that process as well. And so our communities take these things very, very seriously. But if you want to know exactly how your local community handles your ballot, I would suggest reaching out to your clerk and they'll be able to tell you exactly all the measures that go into making sure that your ballot is secure.
Megan, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Megan Wolf is administrator of the Wisconsin Elections Commission, talking about voting this year. We've also got a link to the websites that Megan referenced on our website. Just visit WPR.org/Central Time. Wisconsin's COVID cases are skyrocketing, and last week, our state registered the highest number of people hospitalized with COVID-19 since the pandemic began. Plus, many college campuses in Wisconsin that started with in-person instruction have had to move to online instruction to try and control spikes in COVID cases. While we've been living with the reality of this pandemic for more than 6 months, there's still a lot of confusion and uncertainty about how to keep ourselves and the people we love safe. What questions do you have? There's a line for you at 800-642-1234. Are you unsure of how to judge the risks of different activities? Do you wonder when and how to be tested for COVID-19? Call 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We've got Dr. John Ohoro, who's an infectious disease specialist at Mayo Clinic Health System, joining us. He works in La Crosse, Wisconsin, and also at Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota. He's a graduate of the University of Wisconsin-Madison and the Medical College of Wisconsin. Dr. Ohoro, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Let's start with more basic information. Right now, what do we know about the best ways to avoid being infected by this new coronavirus?
So the best measures for preventing coronavirus infection at this point have been pretty stable over the past few months, meaning we've recognized the important role of masking in public spaces, indoor spaces and crowded outdoor spaces, maintaining physical distance, hand washing, and keeping a close tab on symptoms. So if you do start to feel that you may be sick, you can avoid infecting others. It's something that even though we know these measures work, they are very difficult to really do for a prolonged period. And as this has dragged on for months and months, some of what we're seeing right now with this current spike probably reflects the general public's fatigue with all of these measures, which really are quite intrusive in our day-to-day life.
Yeah. Some of the most recent news is that this coronavirus can be spread in an aerosol form instead of just larger droplets. Can you explain the difference for us and what it means for our safety?
Sure. Aerosol and droplet exist along a continuum. What an aerosol really is a very, very small droplet. And because it doesn't weigh as much, it can travel much further than a standard droplet. Like if you were to sneeze and see the little droplets appear on your computer screen, those kinds only typically go 6 feet or less. Now, these aerosols can go significantly farther and hang around in the air for a lot longer. Now, the question that's been debated among a lot of health professionals is how significant the aerosol role is generally. There's little debate that there are definitely cases of people being infected from aerosols, but most of these have either been in very poorly ventilated spaces, which would allow the virus to stick around longer, or where there's been some sort of aerosol-generating activity going on, where either somebody's getting a medical procedure, which we know when you're working on the airway, you can cause more aerosols to be generated, or some other activities like a lot of exertion or singing in the case of a choir outbreak in Washington State a few months ago, likely generated some aerosols above and beyond the what we would normally see. From a practical standpoint, on a day-to-day basis, we don't really see much in the public from aerosol transmission that seems to be limited to these specific settings. But that's something that still is an area of open debate and investigation about under what circumstances that becomes relevant.
All right. Thank you, Dr. Ohoro. We're talking with Dr. John Ohoro about COVID-19, and we're taking your calls at 800-642-1234. Sounds like Kevin in Madison has a kind of related question here. Hey, Kevin.
I have a scheduled appointment for a regular clean and check at my dentist office. Wondering what, you know, if it's safe to do that. I think they're taking extensive precautions, but I'm still a little worried.
All right, Kevin, thanks for that question. Yeah, Dr. Ohoro, because a dentist's office is one of these places that you might encounter more aerosols.
Yeah, so dentist's office and healthcare providers generally are taking fairly extensive precautions against COVID-19. And as long as they are taking these sorts of precautions, like having people mask in the waiting room, ensuring that their staff are masked and so forth, the risk in those settings is fairly well managed and fairly low. It's something where we're seeing an increased risk of people having other conditions, other medical conditions are going unchecked because they're afraid to see physicians or dentists or other healthcare providers during COVID. And that's some of the hidden toll of this. So if you have a visit that you need to make with a healthcare provider and those appropriate measures are in place, by all means. Now, if you are somebody who has an immune compromising condition or someone who's immune compromised in your family, that is something that becomes a little bit more difficult to say for something like a cleaning, if that's necessarily worthwhile, if it's not a indicated intervention, like if you're not having something like a tooth drilled or treated, if that could be put off a little bit longer, that's a personal choice at that point. But I encourage anybody who has a medical condition to not put off their visit or discussing that with their healthcare providers because of COVID, as long as there are masks in place and appropriate precautions being taken at the healthcare facility.
There are many clinics or facilities who list information about the precautions they're taking on their websites. What if they don't, or what if you don't have internet access? Should we be asking about precautions before we show up in person?
Absolutely. I just think that that's a very appropriate thing to call ahead for, because that is most of them will be very happy to tell you exactly what they're doing and should be giving you some indication that they would expect you to be wearing a mask. And this is one of the ways that you can take your safety into your own hands, is checking to make sure that if you're going to go to such a facility, A, you're complying with what they would expect you to do, and B, they're complying with what you would expect them to do for your safety.
All right. Thanks for that explanation. And we'll make sure to ask those questions, not for just for ourselves, but for everybody. We've also got Charles on the line from Eau Claire. Hi, Charles.
Hi. I was wondering if your guest could talk about the different tests that are done and what the results mean, that you've had the coronavirus or that you're currently shedding virus. And I had a second question, too. In areas with higher air pollution, there's studies that have been done that the coronavirus can kind of hitch a ride on these particulate matter 2.5s, I believe. And I was wondering if your guest could talk about that.
All right, Charles, thanks for the question. Dr. O'Hara, do you have any experience looking at the studies with air pollution?
Yeah, so with air pollution, I'm not familiar personally with the ones about the particulates allowing it to travel further, so I can't comment on that. I do know there is a association between air pollution and worse disease, because this is a respiratory illness, so we would expect that anything that decreases air quality and increases respiratory inflammation to make it a little bit harder to fight this off and make this a little harder. So some of the things like the wildfires impact on air pollution and air quality across the U.S. are things that public health officials are keeping a close eye on with some interest as to how that will impact the pandemic.
Yeah, and then Charles is wondering about those tests, because we do hear lots of different kinds of tests and what they tell us and what they actually don't mean. Where do we start to try to understand that?
Yeah, broadly speaking, at this point, there are two main tests. There are several others that are still entering the field, but the two main ones are the PCR-based tests, which are the nasal swab or nasal pharyngeal swab. That's the deeper swab that goes all the way to the back of the throat from the nose. And what that is looking for is the actual virus itself. Is looking for the genetic material to tell you that the virus is present, or at least fragments of its genetic code are. And that's used a lot in diagnosis of this because of recognition that these viral particles can continue to be shed, or at least some fragments of them can continue to persist for some time after infection. The CDC is currently recommending against retesting those for persons who are positive to demonstrate clearance, because we know that although infections being spread after 10 to 20 days is exceedingly rare, some people stay positive for weeks and months, even though they aren't transmissible. The other one is the blood test, which is usually at this point an antibody-based test. What that's looking for is evidence of prior infection. This is being used mostly in some of these seroprevalence studies, but also to help clarify some other unusual results. And that really tells you that somebody was infected, but it doesn't really tell you exactly when, and needs to be interpreted in context of that.
All right. Actually, let's keep talking about antibody tests with Mary from Wisconsin Dells, who's ready to join the conversation. Hi, Mary.
Hi. I was just wondering, my daughter got coronavirus and tested positive, didn't believe it, went back and got tested positive again. So she quarantined. And then, like a month after her quarantine, she went back to test for antibodies, and she was negative. So we're just curious if she can get it again, why she wouldn't have antibodies. Could she still be, said she was negative, but we're just wondering how close we can get to her.
Oh, yeah. Mary, thanks for the call.
Yeah, so in that situation, I would definitely trust the PCR, both because it's safer for everyone else to do, and because there are a number of caveats that go with the interpretation of antibody testing in a number of ways that you can be negative. It could be that it was too soon after the initial test and that the antibody response isn't strong enough yet. It could also be that it was too far afterwards, because the antibody response does taper off over time. And there is some concern that people can get reinfected. We don't know how prevalent this is with COVID-19, but we know with other coronaviruses, like the ones that cause the common cold, that immunity doesn't necessarily persist. So there would be reason to believe that the antibodies could trail off over time. There are other parts of the immune system that may be sensitized as well. So even though that test is negative, there's also some suggestion that those with a prior infection may have a more mild infection a second time around, but this is still an area with a lot of unknowns.
And Dr. O'Hara, you said trust the PCR. Which test do we trust then?
The first test, the one that was positive in this case.
That confirmed the infection. Okay.
Mm-hmm. The one that confirmed the infection, yes.
We're talking with Dr. John Ohoro right now. He's an infectious disease specialist at Mayo Clinic Health System in La Crosse, Wisconsin, also works at Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota. And we're taking your calls about the new coronavirus, what you want to know about COVID-19. You can call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Still time for your call in this conversation. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. This is Central Time. I'm Keeley Boltina, and we're talking with Dr. John Ohoro of the Mayo Clinic Health System in La Crosse and the Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota. He's sharing the latest information on COVID-19 and taking your questions at 800-642-1234. Dr. Ohoro, with fall and winter holidays coming up, people are trying to figure out if it's safe to travel and see family or even what to do if they do get together. Where should we start to figure out how to handle these winter months?
Yeah, so it's important. The term social distancing has been abandoned largely in favor of physical distancing, to recognize that it really is important, as this has dragged on for months, for people to remain connected. And that does mean an increased role of doing things like phone calls, video calls, or other ways of staying in touch with relatives and friends. Now, as we approach the fall with things like Thanksgiving and the holidays thereafter, it will be more challenging to control spread if people congregate in the way they would in past years. That wouldn't be advisable to have large family gatherings like you may have in prior years. In that same vein, if it's not strictly forbidden to do so for people who are maintaining appropriate precautions with each other. This gets into what's called the bubble approach, which has been discussed a few times with things like the in professional sports, where you have a group of people who are essentially exposed to one another and accept that within that small bubble, which might be a family, it might be roommates, it might be a very small group, you can still get together. But that bubble has to remain small enough that you can really enforce that everybody within that group is taking responsibility for that community's health. So get-togethers using a bubble approach may be a strategy that people use this upcoming fall and winter. But that's something that takes a lot of attention to detail and a lot of trust of the members of your group.
Yeah. Let's talk with Anjali in Madison now. Anjali, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Yes, I have a similar question to the bubble question, but specifically with respect to children. I have two daughters, and both, one is in middle school and one is in high school, and each has a friend with whom they would like to form a pod. And I'm wondering, how does the bubble approach work or the pod approach work? Do people have to get tested regularly to make sure that they are still healthy? Or how do we, even though we're, you know, pretty much quarantining and keeping to ourselves in the small group, how does the bubble approach or the pod approach work?
Anjali, thanks for the question. Similar but different to the conversation about holidays.
Yeah, that's a great question on the pods there. And there are no hard and fast rules on this, but I'll give some general principles that I follow and advise on this. One of them is your group should be at a size where it's small enough that you really understand who is in that group, which is to say that if you have another family who is participating in two pods because they have two daughters in the situation that you're in here, you know that their pod effectively includes yours. So you should really have a good understanding, be able to get a grasp on who is involved, because as that chain spreads out, the effectiveness of this as a mitigation measure gets lower. Secondly, everyone in there should be very responsible about the activities like masking, hand hygiene, physical distancing, because you really are trusting everyone in that to protect your pod or bubble community. Third, and this is probably the single most important thing that I recommend, is within that there has to be no social repercussions for canceling plans at the last minute. I say that because it's very important that if any member of that group starts to question whether or not they're unwell, they should have a free pass to say, you know what, we're going to call off the play date, the dinner, or whatever else is going to be, because that's how you would keep your pod safe. Testing of asymptomatic persons or regular testing isn't part of any routine pods in the general public at this point, and that's something that may change as this goes forward. Some of the sports teams have used that, but that's not something that I require of my own bubble, for example, at this point. But that's something that is going to, that may evolve as the testing changes and the testing availability continues to change.
Dr. Ohoro, then, if you don't get tested in the beginning, would you, if you're just starting up a bubble or a pod, would you everybody separately quarantine for a certain amount of time first before then getting together more regularly?
So a lot of that depends on how well you know your pod members and what they've been doing. In my own group, I happen to know that everybody was effectively quarantined before we decided to start to do some pod activities for socialization of children and so forth. So that I'm not sure I would require it to restart at that point, but it all depends on how well you know that pod and if somebody is entering it who suspects that they may have had some exposure. That comes back to that responsibility and the freedom to cancel plans to say, you know what, I'm out of the pod for the next 2 weeks because I, now that I think of it, I'm at high risk.
Yeah. Dr. John Ohoro is an infectious disease specialist at Mayo Clinic Health System. He works here in Wisconsin and in Minnesota. We're talking about COVID-19. We've got Dwayne from Weston who has a question. Hi, Dwayne.
Oh, good afternoon. So early on from China, the epidemiologist over there, they said they noticed people with O-type blood that were getting it less severe or not getting it to the near percentage of other types. And then it kind of died down on that. You never heard anything. And then later on, a couple months ago, there was a published report over here about it. And I was just wondering if he's heard of that and if there's any validity to it, you know, and what, you know, that might explain why some people get just the sniffles over like full scale, you know, symptoms.
Yeah. Dwayne, thanks for that question, because Dr. Ohoro, we've heard from health experts who say we don't know who's going to get this really bad and who's just going to have a minor issue with COVID-19. Do we know if blood type has anything to do with it at this point?
Yeah, so there is definitely some evidence to suggest that blood type plays a role. And as the caller indicated, O-type blood may be at lower risk. There's some thought that might have to do with some of the antibodies that are associated with different blood types or some of the clotting factors. But what's not really clear is how significant this role is or if that's going to pan out in the long term as being a significant risk factor, because this disease seems to be very multifactorial. When we look at who gets really sick and who doesn't, it usually isn't just one risk factor. We're looking at the cumulative risks that come from things like age, gender. Males are much more likely to get more severe disease and different comorbid conditions. And a big part of this is comorbidities, other conditions that we just might not know about as of yet. So it's very plausible and very interesting to think that blood type might be a part of this, but how big a role that plays is very uncertain right now.
Let's fit one more call into this jam-packed discussion. We've got Erica in Lansing, Iowa. Hi, Erica.
Hi. Hi. I'm wondering about the antibody testing, kind of getting back to that. So does the antibody testing test specifically for COVID-19, or is it just looking at coronavirus? So, you know, like the coronavirus that causes the common cold, or is it very specific to COVID-19?
Erica, thanks for the question. Dr. Ohoro.
Yeah, there's a variety of different lab tests out there at this point, and each of them are, some of them are looking at different targets, but they really are trying, and most of them do target specifically for COVID-19. Now, there is the possibility of there being some cross-reactivity between COVID-19 and other coronaviruses, depending on the test. It's something that hasn't been really all that well studied, but the antibody tests that I'm most familiar with that are used by some of the major institutions tend to be fairly specific to COVID-19.
Dr. Ohoro, thank you so much for answering all of the questions that remain, and I'm sure we'll talk with you about this in the future as we figure out how to live during this pandemic. Thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Dr. John Ohoro is an infectious disease specialist at Mayo Clinic Health System in La Crosse, Wisconsin. He also works at Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota, and we've been talking about the COVID-19 pandemic.